the essential podcast for educators in the UK, made by teachers for teachers.
Hello and welcome to Homework Podcast. Today we are looking at timetabling, what makes the cut. So basically, we were having a chat and we were saying that there's lots of things on our different timetables and different timetables across the country that some people say, really, you don't have time for that, or really, you managed to get that on the curriculum, or how do you find time? So, gents, what are your big kind of things that you think, oh, I wish we didn't have to teach that, or that you see perhaps more value in, limited value in? Let's hear what your thoughts are.
All right, I'll start this off. As someone who's, as I've mentioned before, a Year 6 teacher, historically, Roman numerals.
Sounds trying to get
Roman numerals.
Right. The only reason I'm saying this is because, yes, clearly, it could come up in the SATs paper.
One question,
so it's literally a lesson, maybe even half a lesson we teach it on. But like, genuinely, why do the children need to know?
They don't.
Like, honestly, what's the value?
Clocks.
There's no value.
Clocks. I am actually looking at a lovely Jones
cricket
of London
and rugby
clock.
The Jones of London. Shout out to Jones of London.
Nicely, there are other clockmakers available and other cities. It's perched, I've got to describe this, it's perched beautifully above a shelf with a smorgasbord of gin bottles in David's conservatory here in lovely sunny Crawley. So anyway, we digress. But yes, yeah, Roman numerals, entirely pointless.
I just think, like, obviously there's a moment where it could come up in paper. Yes, we prepare for it. At what point, though, is it really going to impact on children's life?
And the best thing is, David's just said for clocks. Well, we teach them the time.
Yeah,
so any child that can pass their maths out anyway would be able to work out.
Yeah.
The only other place you ever see it is on Kings and Queens.
Yeah.
And the
end of a TV show.
I don't even know if they do that anymore because no one watches the ends of TV shows anymore.
Sports teams,
like what?
You'd have like the England 15 for the weekend cricket and rugby, it comes up
like
a lot.
49th Super Bowl.
Like, yeah, Super Bowl.
It's obvious they were obviously big on it at Hogwarts.
Yeah.
So you'd keep it?
No. I don't know. No, I do roughly know.
If there is a single member of our wonderful, wonderful Homework Podcast crew out there that actually sees a value in actually teaching children them rather than just picking them up naturally for the very few occasions they need them, please tell us. Please explain it. Because every time you ask this question, everybody gets that glazed look and then says Roman numerals.
I think also it's worth saying that we've got some children that do find place value number tricky as it is.
and we're trying to
confuse them with a different number system altogether. It seems like a waste of
And life. Especially, I mean, okay, if we're going down the David route of, oh, well, sometimes like we might need them for certain things. I know you're bantering. But why do they then need to know what 784 is in Roman numerals?
No,
you're right. There's like set ones that you might come across in life.
I can see a value in 5, 10, 1 maybe knowing that you don't have more than 3.
Yeah.
But that's it.
It's just like code cracking, isn't it? Like
it's just, as you say, I mean, I'm going to get you one of my famous rants, but that is what really, really winds me up, is that we've got children in our schools that can't read, write, or count properly, and we're still expected to say to them, just so you know, guys, when you have figured out how to write 723 in normal Arabic numbers, you can then try and do it in a totally different language. What is the point?
No, it doesn't give the children anything extra that they need in life.
Right, so this is like room 101, isn't it?
Chuck it in.
I wish we had a case to back. Roman numerals gone from the curriculum.
I'm glad I convinced you both, so easily.
This is one I'm not really clued up enough to say what value it adds either way, but like modern languages, I know would be a contentious issue. I learned French at GCSE. I learned a lot of modern language
Latin.
I think I wouldn't call Latin a modern language.
It's an ancient language.
I learned French and Spanish at secondary school. And between starting secondary school and doing GCSE, that's what, like 6 years of learning, 4 or 5, 6 years of learning. I do understand that there's a view that at primary school you could open children's eyes to things, you could give them a taste of different things. I do wonder with the other, in my mind, perhaps more pressing things that could be fitted into a school day, how much value learning to count in French, actually adds. I know you've got a really good offering, haven't you, of modern languages at your school?
Yeah, I mean, we teach a myriad of, and we have a specialist come in to teach Mandarin to our year sixes. But it's interesting to say that, because I'm sure the wonderful, wonderful people at Teacher Tap Other research agencies are available.
Yeah, yeah.
We're running a poll this week, and I didn't actually partake in it, but I did see the results, and I'm sure that foreign languages was if when teachers were asked, that was what they would drop from the curriculum.
And I imagine that, and we again have like a specialist come in and teach French, but I imagine teacher subject knowledge for those that do have to teach it, they probably feel either that they're kind of like absolutely winging it, or that they're quite nervous to try and teach it properly with the accents, the pronunciation.
Like you said, I learned Spanish and French at school and did it up to GCSE and did fine it, but I would genuinely be quite...
What is fine?
What is fine? Let's see those grades. I've never seen Sam. Looks so
awkward. David, I'll stay off French of B.
Oh, come on. What are you worried about?
What did you get?
C.
Okay.
Yes.
Spanish, B.
I didn't do it for GCSE.
That's private school education, ladies and gents. The state school board.
I didn't do Latin, though. What did you get in Latin?
I didn't, that was again...
He's going to give you a Latin answer.
I did philosophy and ethics for GCSE.
Philosophy and ethics for GCSE. So if you do fancy teaching your child the meaning of life but not a language...
Just come to me.
Head to Mr. Keats' class.
I would be quite fearful, though. If someone said to me...
I teach Spanish.
I don't think I'd be the
point is, I think with primary school, is that the content is so... bare, if you like, it is basic. That doesn't bother me. And this is where perhaps this idea, and this is definitely something that we
could
need
we
to talk
hear
about.
Some Spanish then, just for the listeners.
CC. This is something that is Spanish, isn't it? No, that's
French.
That's
wee. Good Lord,
no swearing for the podcast. Anyway, moving swiftly on before we start getting complaints to Ofcom. I've lost my train of thought. My point being that you can. I feel that you could. That I'm perfectly confident and competent.
Here we go.
To teach Spanish at primary level. However, I personally would question my subject knowledge in teaching something like music. So there is a call, for. And I know that a lot of schools are doing that. We have a specialist music teacher that comes in. That for perhaps the more specialised subjects, primary schools are more and more now getting in. Specialist teachers, sports coaches, loads of schools now are getting specialist sports coaches. That was unheard of when we were kids. And well, for Sam and I. I can see, and I know that what the riposte often is, that it's the arrogance of English people that they don't need to speak another language. I don't necessarily think it's arrogance. I think it's just an awareness of what the social situation is. Is that, I mean, I worked in the Middle East. Everyone from the Bangladeshi taxi driver that I used to have to the Filipino bar staff that were in the bar that I used to drink in to my Emirati colleagues at school all spoke English.
Yeah.
In some way, shape or form.
We're fortunate it's a very universal language, of course. And we are often put in situations, like you're saying with your job, that actually... it would actually work great for you because they were mainly predominantly English speaking, which is really helpful.
Mm.
I think a question that probably needs to be asked is, say if a school did drop MFL at primary level, would the children who then end up going to the local secondary school be at a disadvantage to those children also in the local area who did do it?
But how efficient do you think the assessment is of it anyway?
Oh, I agree.
That's so, the other thing I don't quite understand is there seems to be, this applies for a lot of primary school subjects, there seems to be, as I mentioned, this view that, they need to get a taste for it to spark that love. But I don't, and there probably is lots of research into it, but I just haven't seen research to suggest that, for example, giving children a taste of French aged 8 makes them more eager to learn French aged 12 than children that haven't learned French aged 8 and do then get exposed to it at age 12. I don't know if it actually, the depth in which it's taught, the lack of differentiation, I would imagine, in which I don't imagine MFL is taught, I haven't seen it, but I don't imagine it's taught to the same varying level of scaffold and differentiation as other subjects. I just don't know how much need there is for it at that age.
That could be our school. It could be the situation we're in. We do have a French specialist that comes in, but I think it's sort of taken away from us as teachers and we don't see it. We don't know quite how it's a level of assessment, level of differentiation, level of support. Maybe for you, Ben, in your school, clearly the offering is different.
I think for us, that's different. I think that is what it comes down to for my SLT, is actually that they want to kind of give children an opportunity to experience language.
Yeah.
So therefore, hence why we teach
to my knowledge, correct me if I'm wrong, French, Spanish, and Mandarin. Mm. Now, that's down to what the teachers in the in the year groups prefer to teach, because we're very, I mean, I'm fairly confident that if I wanted to teach German, I could teach German, because the curriculum merely dictates a modern foreign language.
Sure.
Unfortunately, David has rightly told us that Latin is not
it's
available.
Such a shame.
However, Latin is still often taught in private schools across the country. So why, like, there's a whole other debate there. So, I mean, languages, I agree, it is a tricky one. Assessment is a tricky one. Essentially, you're doing the speaking and listening element of the English curriculum in a foreign language. And I'd say that the speaking and listening facet of English is the least assessed. So how are we actually assessing it anyway?
I think it's just that, like, the other things that we could be teaching children in that weekly time.
Yeah, especially...
Even non-subject basic life skills, how to eat, use proper cutlery properly, excuse the jokes. But just life skills, I think, at the age of 8 to 12, for example, I just feel that they would benefit more from.
Or more things like computing that are directly going to impact their lives. And I think that, I mean, this is another controversial one, but I have a difficult relationship with the teaching of RE, because I think if you look at it statistically, the vast majority of this country, even if they perhaps register themselves as Christian officially on censuses, would say that they've not attended church and don't observe many of the cultural tenets that come with that. I'm perfectly happy to teach RE, and I'd like to think I teach it perfectly well. However, a lot of it is PSHE. A lot of it is right and wrong, morals.
If you're teaching
the creation story of Sikhism, there's an argument that that's history.
I agree, and I think, as you say, like, it does blend into PSHE, and I think the key thing is children being like rounded and understanding citizens with appreciations of cultures. But cultures aren't necessarily just religious cultures, are they? There's lots of different things attributing to, like, appreciating that culture around you. And it's also like there's often different cultures amongst white Brits that I don't think are addressed at all in schools. Economic culture differences are
how many of our children fully understand what travellers are?
This is what I mean.
I have any conception that travellers and gypsies are two totally different things, two totally different cultures.
So wrong.
I think it is hard. I almost wonder if we need to create like a new super subject that sort of tries to encompass as much of this as possible. There was a whole time where British values was talked about continually, and I know that is deeply rooted in PSHE. But I do wonder if it's more that we should be looking at creating almost like humanities is an overarching subject,
like
more at secondary school. And it is, but I do think that, because I think it's nice that our children are a kind of given an understanding in each year group of a different religious culture. Yeah. Are our children in year six actually able to even recall what they learnt in year two about
Judaism? I'm sure you would say so. Like, we can do a job teaching it, but my knowledge of the Jewish story, like, I was teaching that a few weeks back. Like, I was having to swat up before the lesson because it's things I honestly just didn't know about.
And if they ask a question, now I know we're all sort of 21st century teachers here, we all know that we can say to our children we don't know the answer. But it is nice to be able to at least show that you have a fair knowledge.
And it's like pronunciation of words and stuff.
Especially if it's in a different language.
I was teaching the Pillars of Islam, and I think for me in my class, I've got three or four Muslim children, and actually it was great. To be fair, because it gave them a real sense of empowerment, because they were able to share, they were able to bring sort of artifacts in from home, and then sort of objects of interest for that religion.
Demonstrate them,
and they were able to talk about it. That was great. But I think you're right. A year's time from now, when they're in year six, will they really look back and think, "I remember what that child said"? Mm. Possibly not. I think for us, it's far more powerful just to enable our children to be accepting.
Yep.
And to be tolerant and to understand that there are people, and David's right, not just religious differences, but cultural differences, socioeconomic differences, and just being able to see our community as one. Mm-hmm. Because you can be so divisive in a community.
Especially with the way
that... And together is so much more important.
Especially the way that catchments work. Like, you can have a child that's sitting in a in a council house with two unemployed parents sitting next to a child who is living in a £2.5 million house.
Yeah. And we have that.
Yeah, I think most schools do. Yeah. I think most schools have. Yeah. I mean, I'm perhaps not quite to those extremes, but there is a massive, massive range.
And it's understanding how those children then appreciate each other, interact with each other.
And how their parents do.
100%. Yeah. The other thing I was, again, digressing from like RE as a subject, the other thing which has obviously come to the fore with Ofsted's new like revised curriculum framework and, you know, looking at the wider curriculum is like the whole cross-curricular thing. I personally think at schools, there's, and I've only seen my school and a few others, but there's often some great work that's done in the name of trying to produce fancy writing, impressive looking writing. Now, what often we did it recently with a topic on beetles, and we really immersed the children in like different types of beetles, lots of specific vocabulary, and if you looked at their writing, it really was good. But I do wonder, and I have maybe a slight moral issue with how schools are almost pigeonholing knowledge into children to try and get, you know, impressive writing at the expense of teaching. Like, children in my class now know an incredible amount about beetles. Does that, you know, like, how important is that? There's lots of things in the world that they simply do not know about.
Should they be learning about global warming?
That's what I mean. And I wonder where that balance actually is. Plastic waste, healthy foods, you know, there's just things that they could be learning about. Whereas we know people are, there's, you know, it's trying to engage learners, isn't it? But we learn, lots of schools learn about dragon eggs, and there's just lots of things that, yeah, it's great. And there is a balance between that creativity and that.
And is it,
but wonder, like,
I see what you're saying. Do we need to remember that, like, a lot of these children are still 8 and 9, like, and that there's a lot of learning ahead? And I think I'd actually take it forward and say that's perhaps more one of the issues more that I have with things like languages and RE, even DT, is that they've got 6 years, 5-6 years at secondary school with specialist teachers in specialist rooms with specialist resources, that I actually think perhaps there are times where it needs looking at again, is what I would say. Because I don't want parents listening to think that we're sat there bemoaning having to deliver these subjects. But it is something that I think that if you were to rip up British education and start again, I think it would be done very differently. And I remember at uni a teacher tutor saying to me, it's very difficult to get something onto the curriculum, it's almost impossible to take it off, because you almost have to prove that humans no longer need that knowledge. And that is why Roman numerals are still on there. So this is a controversial one.
Go on.
Handwriting. It's the issue that I have with it is that people still need to be able to write. However, they don't need to be able to write cursively, beautifully, every single letter spaced out the same. I understand why at school we do it, the fine motor skills, the presentation, pride in your work, ease of being read. There's a whole range of motivations for doing it. But if you said to parents now that your child at 12 can touch type or they can write beautiful cursive handwriting, most parents would want them to be able to touch type, I would have thought.
I think the world that we live in, the jobs that these children will have in the future, and not even jobs, but just the sort of life activities and tasks you'll have to do, will all be so electronic and computerized.
What jobs do people do where they handwrite all day, other than us?
But
all our planning is typed. Every office job, architects, everything, like, I mean, you could say that the building industry, well, I know plenty of builders that use iPads, that use their mobile phones. They've not sat there. They might be making lists by pencil and pad, or they might be quickly noting something down. But as long as they can read it, it's a tough one that I'm kind of concerned with.
Legible handwriting is what surely we should be after, because the skill of writing still needs to exist.
Mm-hmm. I think it can be counterproductive as well, in that I've got children in my class who have, like, the best writing I've ever seen in terms of handwriting, but in terms of actually producing, like, the output in the lessons, that is almost detrimented by the fact that they're trying so hard to present it beautifully,
join
cursively, and in terms of actually wanting to get the ideas from their head onto the paper.
And it works the other way too. Like, I've got children who, to be honest, don't have the best handwriting, but have some exquisite ideas, and their writing just, the way it's formed, the transcription of, like,
so if those children were offered a high powered, so quickly quick processing laptop, to type up their work, yeah. and from say year three or four, once they had learned how to handwrite, mm-hmm. they were able to type up everything, or type up say 80% of their work. Their ideas would be better. Their work would be better.
I think it is.
I've got lots of children like that. Their work would be better.
It would. Yeah. And that fear, I think a lot of children have fear.
Yeah, too right. And they look at their page, and if they've always struggled with it, they hate it.
How easy would that be? Like, sort of dreaming now, but like, if you could get the children to type their work with like a system that didn't have spell check and underline of that, and then as a teacher, you could then like undo that feature, so then all of the spellings and corrections would just be highlighted for you. It would be amazing.
No, it would, and I honestly believe that is where we will end up. Okay. Because
we're grey and old talking.
Some youngster will steal our idea. But you know, like, it's a tough one. Yes, we need to be able to write legibly. Yes, we want children to be able to physically pick up a pencil or a pen and write something.
Yeah.
But my future children, I want them to be able to have the skill set that they need to succeed and to go on in their life as early as possible. There's an argument over should we be teaching children how to use an iPad or a mobile phone keypad? Yeah. Because, fine, you can say, oh, well, they'll pick that up. And of course they will. You see the speed that some teenagers, I type quickly. But people do pick it up because they want to be able to. But I do have an issue that you look around university lecture rooms now and people very rarely are making notes because they're sat there typing on their keyboards.
And it's also like, I worked in like a phone-based, computer-based job for a few years before getting into teaching, and I would have to write by hand like fairly often, but it would be things that I was jotting down when I was on the phone.
Yeah.
And like, you're often like missing out letters and stuff. Yeah. It's not that I can't spell, but it's just like, it speed. Is just speed. Yeah. And as you say, with builders, there'll be builders using iPads. There'll also be builders with pads, but they're just, it's all like it's jargon, isn't it? It's they this. Understand it. It's authors, sometimes do that.
I mean,
but then they don't type, you know, then they type everything up. So
I was taught shorthand for my journalism degree.
Yeah, actually. Really.
So, we're going back 2008. I was taught shorthand. What on earth?
Yeah.
What a waste of time for me.
Yeah.
I completely accept that there's probably listeners out there that that you still use shorthand. Like, I know a couple of people that take minutes at meetings and they use shorthand. Mm-hmm. However, we've got recording devices built into every mobile phone that if you're just taking shorthand to then type it up, just record it.
I wonder how much things would change if the... it's the objective, isn't it, to get greater depth in SATs, isn't it? Or in writing moderation to have the
cursive consistency.
I wonder if that was removed, how that would change a culture within schools of that. I also think there's perhaps, and this is just a hunch, but I think book scrutinies, I think neat books with good handwriting, I think that has more weight than often than it does.
Not to mention hearing a colleague or someone from another school saying as soon as they open a book, oh, I bet this is a girl.
Yeah, but I hate
also,
that.
We're probably guilty, but how many of us, if we tweet a child's work, let's be fair,
we
probably tweet a book that's beautifully presented.
And how many of us have the kind of the expectation with displays, etc., is that all work is nice and beautiful and clear. And
absolutely.
Like, that difficulty of perhaps that child with autism or any other kind of SEN, or even just a child that struggles with their writing, schools are still going to put that work up.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it is that kind of, you know, that when visitors are coming around, they're not looking at it and going, oh, wow, how beautiful.
Well, I think to touch on the handwriting as well and the sort of sense of use of technology, like, I visited the secondary school that our primary school sort of feeds to, visiting a lot of children who were there previously, and they all either have a tablet, a laptop, or facilities to use a desktop. Mm. And all of their homework is set electronically, and they type everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I genuinely asked the question. I said, I know at our school, we don't do an awful lot of like use of technology in that sense. Like, how have you found it? And they all absolutely loved it. And these are children that did sometimes find class quite tricky.
Because what are they doing when they're getting home? It's, they're going on these things. Yeah.
It's the norm. And also, like, their parents, I think it's important to say that a lot of parents do engage with their phones, with tablets a lot better. And if a child's home learning, or however it's worded, homework, is set on there, they're more likely to possibly engage with them too.
Yeah.
So what do we do about the children that can't afford that technology?
This is the problem. It's the same in schools.
It's not. It's a solvable problem. It's a completely solvable problem that the government have an obligation to.
Oh, of course.
Like,
they wanted to.
You put half a penny on everyone's tax, and it's means tested. Pupil premium children, for example, are given X budget, or the school, but school produce
1500 a kid, isn't
whatever, it? Whatever. But in terms of like, it's a totally solvable problem, and that's what people will say. Though, is what about the children that don't have access to it? Yeah. Well, you ask a normal school, even in a socially deprived area, how many of you haven't got access to technology at home?
What do we think about teachers' modelling of handwriting, like as in when writing in books and also on the board?
The problem is that like. So I have quite good handwriting. My head teacher has commented.
Oh, well done.
But the reason why I'm proud
really
of that, I am gonna talk about it. So the reason why I talk about this and why I'm quite passionate about it is because I hold my pen. I'm just going to get Sam to chuck me a pen and I can demonstrate. I hold my pen.
We're going
to
see the coin.
David has just said
oh my
it
god! Oh, it's cool. I wouldn't want to see him with chopsticks.
Talent.
So. I have a very unique. In fact, I've met I think two other people in my life that hold their pen in the same way that I do.
He's got the end of it in his mouth.
I'm left-handed. I do not have the end of it in my mouth. I'm left-handed anyway. And as a child, I had a hard time writing and not smudging my work. So I had a series of teachers up until year four that literally at times tried to physically force me to change my grip, and I just couldn't do it.
No.
Once I got to year four, my teacher just said, however you want to write, as long as it's neat, I don't mind. And I was absolutely fine. And for the rest of my life, I've had very nice handwriting. And my head teacher, in fact, even has complimented me on my handwriting. So I don't have too much of an issue with it. However, a colleague that I had that now works in China... awful handwriting, and he would say that the old stereotype of a doctor's handwriting,
yeah,
and it is very hard. Yeah, it's very hard for children.
It's hard to change your writing.
It's so hard, but it's also, I agree with you with the modelling. It's very hard to say to a child this is the expectation, and then not do it yourself. The same way that if you say to a child you need to be checking your spelling, and then you put modelled examples up of spelling mistakes, then they're saying, well, hang on, like. And that's a really tricky one, because what do you do about the teachers whose handwriting is appalling?
I've genuinely, this year, I wouldn't say mine was appalling at the beginning of the year, but it wasn't great. I genuinely have consciously put quite an effort into it, but knowing how, and it is all right now, but knowing how much time and effort that's actually taken me, and how actually I'm genuinely conscious of like leading in and stuff when I'm writing, to think that a child who's got creative ideas in their mind is having to think about the formation of letters. That to me just seems like a sort of hindrance. It seems like a muddle.
What
concept.
What are we bothered about in education?
I know.
Like what are the concerns in our world if we're getting upset that the lead out on a letter X wasn't quite angled at the right point?
What about the contentious issue of which Z to use? Because we've got a school Z now.
A school Z.
I've got a colleague who's from Canada, and she's obviously used a different education system, and they just print in Canada, which is like that. And she actually is a massive advocate for technology as well. In their system, everyone has a tablet. But she has been sort of commented to say, oh, we need to use the cursive script, we need to model. So she's been essentially practicing. And myself and my other year five colleague have been sort of helping her, really. And like Dave said, like, I admittedly probably when I started
yours is quite good now. Josh's is the worst.
Josh struggles, bless him. But we'd have.
Really, Josh being a colleague of.
He's the bloke that gets to mention, like, now
and then. But at the time that I was showing her on the board, our head teacher walks in and he's looking at what I'm doing. He's sort of. Please, I think that we're sort of helping her and modelling how we'd do it. And then a word with the letter Z comes up. And there was huge contention as to who was doing it correctly.
Yeah.
And this almost like prompted then our English lead to then send out a whole revised plan of how we would model the letter Z. And there's been debate, and it's like why some children are like, why are you doing a three? And it's I personally hate...
Sorry, boys and girls. I've just seen David's a demonstration modeling. Of David's. It does look like and I mean, it looks like a hieroglyph.
It's like a three with a G three, and an F.
Yeah.
So the idea, basically, the idea is the Z sits on the line and then there's a loop underneath it, almost correct. Like almost you would like, on a G.
Yeah.
And then it's a descender into the lower line, which...
Well, I've laid a picture
so that whole debate was happening with our head teacher with two other members of staff other than myself, all over one individual letter in the alphabet.
And if you're concerned, and if it's contentious for you, how on earth are the children... How difficult is it for a child that we teach them in some schools that they're taught one style and then halfway through their schooling the school decides to change the policy, so they say to them all those issues that you've had with learning how to handwrite, tough luck now, and they're not even, and in a lot of schools they're not even saying right, we're doing it from now so everybody above them can carry on with the old style and everybody below.
Also with numbers as well, you'd have the four, you can read the four obviously in two different ways, and the seven, do you cross the seven? So there's a few...
You spoke about moderation earlier, though, in the sense that obviously you might want to extend the great depth writer by having that really lovely fluent and cursive...
That's nice to have nice handwriting.
It's nice. But also, like, I have known it through moderation processes. If you've got a child that's a brilliant writer, does everything else, you can just say, oh, but they're not the best handwriter. Mm. And they can still get what they need to do, so it can be argued against.
Also,
anyway.
I'm sure some of the great authors haven't got the best handwriting.
No, absolutely.
So I don't think
handwriting
makes you a greater depth writer.
I know, it's just
almost like art, isn't it? Like, it almost falls into art, not English, I think, this handwriting thing.
I can see what you mean.
It's like calligraphy.
So we've harpooned Roman numerals and we've lambasted modern faro languages, etc. What about then?
We're no longer going to use paper.
Yeah, we're no longer using paper. We will be starting up our own free school.
Which would need a huge budget.
So, what about then? Okay, assemblies. So, I'm just thinking how to word this. So, should schools have assemblies? How frequently should they have them? Who should be delivering them? And are they a worthwhile use of the timetable?
There is a legal obligation, isn't there, for collective worship to be
that
done.
That doesn't
amount,
have to be done in an assembly, do you? Because
could
we
be done as
class.
A class, couldn't it? Which almost, like, again,
I make them bow down to me.
PSA. Yeah, the king. Hail the king. Interesting.
I don't do that, honestly, just to cover myself.
I'll try and answer a few of these questions. Who should give them? I think it's nice if at least once a week the head teacher does give an assembly. I think that's really nice. I think it's lovely. We've also this year had a few like ad hoc assemblies where quite a few of SLT have just been, you know, like on courses or whatnot, and like a few of us have just got up and sort of, you know, done an assembly, and it's actually gone down like really well. The children are really engaged.
I think
it's almost a bit different.
Seeing
and the behaviour,
behaviour was really decent. Because it's less, they're less used to it, so it's like.
And for younger kids, they might not actually. So for us, so after being in upper school. I mean, there's probably children in year one, reception year two, that have never really seen me or yourselves. And I was the school I was at previously, they had four kind of morals for the school, and they took one every half term, which is rotated round. And a teacher was then expected to come up and present an assembly on that kind of focus. So I thought that was great.
That's
and
great
it took
sweet,
20 minutes, and it just sort of gave the teachers that bit of responsibility, it gave them that opportunity. I think
it's nice. I think that's really cool. The other thing, again, I sort of, our school, lots of schools do like a celebration assembly. In my mind, I'm just like, when these things happen, I do wonder what I would be thinking as a pupil. Like, I as a kid, I don't know if I'd want to sit down for 40 minutes. And like, even if it's like the idea of getting a certificate in the front of the hall is quite nice. However, I do wonder if there's perhaps a more child-friendly way of like having these celebrations, because I think it's almost like a sort of adult ceremony, you know, like you sort of sit
formal. I mean, big shout out to my SLT on that one, to be fair, because they come up and they get to sit in the head teacher's chair or the deputy head's chair, and then in a different language. Each week they get to ask for a certain number of spins on the chair.
That's
in front
sweet.
Of
that's
the whole
different.
And that, but because I think that's probably what the decision was that this is very formal and it's very.
Sure.
And the kids do
it's
like
not really
it.
A celebration.
They do like it, I think. I would say, in my experience, kids do like it. They like to be noticed, they like to be recognised. But I do see what you're saying.
I just wonder if
Chris
there's a
Dyson
different
has,
way of doing that, right?
Well, like Chris Dyson has. It's a party, isn't it? And sofas and. And I think there's a middle ground.
Yeah.
And it obviously depends on what works for your catchment. Sure. I do know what you mean, and I think it's almost it's a relic of kind of all of our educations, because as far as I'm aware, it happened when my parents were at school.
Yeah.
And I think that most people have just carried on with it in a fairly general way, because it always has been that way.
Mm-hmm. I also think it's like, let's be serious, children sitting on a cold hard floor for 30 or 40 minutes, like, they obviously are going to be quite uncomfortable. They obviously are going to be tempted to talk to their mate. And they're obviously going to get quite bored, however hard we try with the content. So I think, yes, there's a sense of like social awareness and that you do need to conform to behavioural rules. But I think in certain respects, I do think like a traditional assembly like that does set children up to fail. In a classroom, if you sat children on a carpet without moving and without properly engaging them for 30 to 40 minutes, and you were being observed in a lesson,
you'd be caught up, wouldn't you?
There'd be big questions. And I just think with an assembly, it's like, it's just strange. The other thing, sorry to rant about this, in my mind, if I was the head teacher, I would really want the assembly after lunch. I think the bet that we have one day without assembly, which is a Wednesday morning. Mm-hmm. The children, the work they do, like the way they come in and settle, the whole sort of classroom dynamic is fantastic then. Mm-hmm. And I do get this argument that all children will be a bit lively after lunch and this. To be honest, I'd much rather they're a bit lively after lunch in an assembly hall rather than in a lesson.
Yeah,
and I think we're spending 2 hours at least of the school week in mornings doing assemblies where I think that is probably the absolute peak
level. Okay, so what about something like singing assembly then? If children are having music lessons, and choir is offered, and this is, and I'm not saying for a minute here that I think that they should be scrapped, but I'm just interested. So, for example, our children spend half an hour a week singing as a key stage.
As there was.
As we did when we were children, and as I would imagine our parents did and our grandparents.
Yeah.
And is there an element of that that says actually 10 minutes is enough because it's nice to all get together and have a sing-song? Is it we have... Because think about it, we do PE lessons...
Yeah.
But we don't do any collective exercise, or most schools don't. We've started doing a minute at the end of each playtime, but we don't have, key stage two, like almost kind of Chinese style whole school out on the playground doing star jumps for half an hour, and childhood obesity is rocketing.
I think, I don't know if either of you both aware of this, but there's something that's certainly in Surrey, where I'm working as PE lead, I'm quite sort of aware of this, that there's a big drive on active assemblies. So it's obviously to counter the idea that you've just mentioned, Dave's mentioned, the fact that you've got children sat down for half an hour. And I think the way that that's suggested it could work is that in every assembly, regardless if it's a celebration assembly, regardless if it's a singing assembly, actually you slightly change the dynamic and you'd still deliver whatever content's delivered, but then you do have 5-10 minutes in that assembly where everyone's not just sat down singing, but could be up, standing, singing, could be moving around, could be to share an idea, you have to stand up, like that happens in class anyway in some schools. But the notion of 30 minutes of sitting sedentary is actually completely going against, like you're saying, childhood obesity.
Yeah, yeah.
I think there's some strengths of assemblies, I think.
Oh, yeah, and I love them. I enjoy them, personally.
David and I both, to be honest, most assemblies have a little slot where we do something. Like David delivers like a new word of the week, which the school like has really
I have just been told that David is the word champion.
Head of words.
Head of words.
Doesn't yet carry a tail on.
Head of words.
Yeah. He's got his own parking space.
Yeah, not to kind of besmirch David's fantastic school, I mean that's a new one. Do you get a badge?
A sash.
Oh, we're working on a sash. Yeah,
or a lanyard. Get a lanyard.
I'm very passionate about that.
But that's cool. And I think I have a sports person of the week and I deliver news about fixtures and things. And we've all got little pockets of information that we share, which is
nice. But does that need to be done in an assembly?
I think it could work another way.
Trying to think. Like it's a lot of time.
It's time. Time is issue.
I also think like...
I mean, ours are quite quick. So from the sounds of it, yours are quite a lot longer than ours.
Ours are meant to be 25 to 30.
See, ours are shorter.
Ours do tend to be at least 30, often longer.
Yeah.
How many children are in your assembly?
So our Monday's assembly generally is kind of talking about which classes have done well in their times table rock stars, things like that, the cleanest classrooms, that kind of stuff. And then any kind of really important stuff, like we've had something built or we're going on the field or whatever. And then generally the head will read a story.
Okay.
So it'll be a story, it'll be a picture of it.
I think that
generally has a moral.
I'd like there to be a
moral. And that's the whole school. Apart from, I'm not entirely sure if I think reception is still in there for that now. Yeah,
okay.
So that's the whole school singing the set, and that generally is 20 minutes.
Right,
and that never really runs over because he doesn't want to take too much time out of time.
No, he understands.
That's the problem.
Our singing assembly is half an hour, mm-hmm. and our sort of awards ceremony on a Friday is about half an hour.
So you have 3 a week.
Yeah.
Okay. And so we might do a little bit in class.
So we then have a class assembly, okay. and PSHE is used for the other slot.
Sure.
But again though, like that, I think if you were to ask staff, I think they like having that kind of time on a Wednesday and a Thursday where it's kind of down to them. Like, obviously we have the PSHE to cover, but that kind of class assembly can it be about what you want. So if it is that Trump's doing something mad and perhaps the children have seen it on Newsround and are a bit worried about it, we can discuss it.
If
it's fed. Yeah, yeah. And it's just that opportunity to share. And I think that I do like what we have. I do like that balance, and I do like the fact that he'll randomly say, right, these are five facts that I've learned this week, and sort of really big up the importance of reading and stuff like that. But I look at it, and this is school as a whole, how much are we still doing in the same structure and format that has always happened, when in the actual delivery of the curriculum, we're trying to really kind of be innovative and change and...
I think assemblies, from my take, are a way of leadership, having that direct link to the children, having an influence over the children,
100%.
Over something that they feel, the message that they feel needs to be delivered. I think the question is, as we say, could that be delivered in a slightly different way? I think there probably are sometimes ways that it could be.
Something that your school clearly does quite well, is you have that sort of rigid time where you have, this is what we do, but we understand and appreciate that the importance is we're back in class and we're learning. I think one thing that we do, and it's lovely when it happens, but the build up to it I find quite stressful and time consuming, is we do a class assembly.
So we don't do that.
So we have across a year, two a year
each.
For example, 5S, my class, we'll have to deliver two assemblies where the children essentially are the ones delivering it. I'll plan it with their support.
It's like a mini performance, isn't it?
You then get parents in. But I personally feel like it's almost like an observation.
Well, and how much of your curriculum time is building up to that?
So the one that I did earlier in the year, it was all about gender equality and the children at our school and in sort of the wider community. And
shout out to Graham
Andre. A bit of help from him, which was great. But it was lovely. And the actual moment that it happened, it went brilliantly. But the amount of time that it took to build up to it was really time-consuming, and you lost out on so much teaching
time. And I remember
doing
that as a child and thinking, blimey, we've been doing this for weeks.
It's also like, I do like being out of the comfort zone. That's something I'm passionate about. But however, as a teacher, like me trying to direct a sort of performance, it's hard work. And as you say, you're trying to fit it alongside other learning. So it's not something you've had months and months.
I find it more stressful than observation.
Much more, yeah.
And also, you've got parents.
Well, other teachers are judging as well, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
Everyone does. It'd be lying if...
Apart from the old sibling in the crowd as well, in the audience, do the other children really... Or would it be better just for the parents to come watch it? I don't know. But that is a big time-consuming...
Yeah, and I think that is entirely why we don't do them.
Yeah.
And as much as, on the one hand, I think it's quite nice for the children. On the other hand, I do completely agree with you, and I think it's a huge amount of time to kind of give over to something, especially two. I don't think I've ever heard of
that. Yeah, we do two.
Yeah, two.
So, I mean, assemblies are a tricky one. So, final one then. What do we think about children being removed from lessons to attend, say, sporting events or musical events, performances, if they are already behind with their learning, or... if their behaviour or general conduct is not appropriate? So if your best football player happens to swear 2 days before a big game or push someone, is it still right that they go? Or perhaps that's a different issue. Is it right that they're missing, say, 3 hours of English in the week, despite the fact that they're working below standard?
I'll take a lead on this, if you don't mind. I think
you crack on.
As PE leader, I often am the person that will have to select teams, and I'm the person that also has to go to teachers and say, how do you feel about X and Y missing a bit of your sort of core teaching in the mornings? And more often than not, the teachers are absolutely fine with it. I have found this year, and I would have been the same as a year six teacher previously, the year six teachers are very against it, which I appreciate entirely because of the stresses and pressure they're under. I think, touching on the point where you made about sort of behaviour and linking selection to classroom conduct, essentially, we had a game just this week gone, and for football for the year sixes, and I've got probably arguably the most talented boy in that year group, didn't play. And that was down to his behaviour in class, his sort of work ethic. And that was a decision I made and the sort of other football coach made, but there was backlash. There was questions from parents to say, why? Mm. Why can't you play?
And which is difficult when it might be a private safeguarding issue or...
Absolutely, in this case it wasn't. And that's fine, but just the comments that had to then be made, so actually his learning class isn't where it should be, and he isn't behaving, and to see almost the sport as a reward, and then it would be wrong to then just say, have a bit of time.
Not to mention that, I mean, if you look at a lot of footballers now, I think a lot of them are told if your grades drop, you're not. I know certainly in America, they basically say you have to maintain a certain grade point or you're dropped. Yeah.
We're a long way from that in this country. There's a lot of academies that do wonderful things in terms of education, but there are also a lot of footballers, and this is probably going to change very quickly, but probably players our age who left school with very, very little education.
Aspiring to be a footballer.
Hoping they'd make it, and obviously those who did. But if you don't, you're left...
Which, to be fair, every single time I've taught someone, I had a lad in my class who played for Chelsea 3 years above where he was actually aged. Yep. And the first questions at parents' evening were always, how is he doing academically?
Yeah. Mm. I think it's hard to put a blanket statement, isn't it? Because we've got... To say that children that are behind academically couldn't have time of class or fixtures. Like, I certainly am aware of children who are definitely behind academically, who absolutely thrive in a sporting sense.
And they need that moment.
And what we don't want to do, that is their thing.
Those children still being taken out of PE, computing, etc. for interventions. Yeah, exactly. So we're still taking them out of things that they might enjoy because of the fact that they're behind.
Well, I think there's like a social sort of...
And I'm not saying that they have to. I'm not saying that that's what I vehemently believe. But I think that it is... Say that person is the best sportsman or sportswoman in your year group.
Yeah.
There is a chance. I have kids in my class that might be out of learning for, say, 15 to 25 different afternoons across a year because they're a good runner and a good cricketer and a good footballer. Like,
and
fine, a lot of those kids, it won't be a problem. But some of those kids, as we've said, might be considerably further behind. They might then also do drama club or choir and then be going to performances or rehearsals. And those kids might be far behind. So is it that we actually say all of these events have to happen after school?
Yeah.
I'm not saying that it should. I'm merely saying that if we're providing a broad, wide, balanced curriculum, we're giving them the opportunity to join clubs after school and represent the school in that way.
Yeah.
Our obligation is also to educate these children.
That's our
primary obligation.
Yeah. I just think it's case by case. I think you'll probably have like people that go down in history as great singers who are just like illiterate, and I think not able to.
But I agree with that, but they could have done that external to school.
Potentially, but
I'm not saying I'm being devil's advocate here. Like,
I agree. I understand what you're saying. I had made a decision this year to withdraw our school from one of the associations we're part of. So we're part of two associations, the sort of the local town one, but also the wider district one. And it was just taking up too much of our time. Mm. A lot of things were falling in the school hours, which for me personally was difficult as a teacher to try and get out of class.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I also felt bad for because I was leaving my children. But also I understand that the loss of learning time can be detrimental to the children's progress. I think also what's worth mentioning is some schools do really value sport, music, drama, and they see it as almost a real strength of their school. And if you then have a competition but you don't take your best athletes or musicians because of their behaviour,
or their attainment.
Or their attainment. Like, I think, like, does the school then look in a certain light? I don't know. Like, we had an issue last year with two boys in my year six football team who, I'll be honest, behaved very poorly at a moment. And that meant that we didn't pick them for a fixture against Whitgift. Now, Whitgift are an incredibly sort of gifted school for athletes. Yeah. And it crushed the boys. And that was a decision that sort of went above me. It went to the SLT level. And parents were so...
Would you have taken them?
On ability?
No, but...
Oh, what, it's my choice.
If you don't mind answering, would you have taken them? Thinking about your morals as a teacher, would it have been right to take those children?
What they did, no.
Just to avoid a defeat?
We lost 1-0 against Whitgift.
Yeah.
If they were there, do I think we could have won? Yes. Did it mean that we lost in the quarterfinal of the County Cup? Yes.
Did it mean that they learned a lesson?
I think it did. Which is more powerful.
I think talking about putting fixtures to after school, I think that is a sensible and perhaps better point. What I just can't like really accept is children that are academically behind, who probably know that they are and struggle every single day at school, mm-hmm. who would just mm-hmm. be finding... They'd almost, and they love the sport, and they'll just find it a punishment to not be allowed to do the sport with their mates. And they're used to being seen as someone that's like struggling. No,
they'll probably behave in a different way too when they know that their mates are at this fixture and they're not there.
I find that really hard to think. Oh, you can't. They're being punished for something they love because they. If their behaviour is what's affecting their academic performance, but if they are just somebody that is
struggles
at school, loves the sport, is quite good at sport, I think it's really like I'd struggle to say they couldn't do the sport because of that. I think it's. trying to find a way to allow them to succeed at both.
I think there's so many pressures on time. It's just, I know how frustrating, especially in what we're talking about with year six and the pressures on every single lesson. I think it's obviously just one of those that I know sometimes you think, oh, I've got this lesson, you think, oh, I'm missing that trial again. And it's that catch up, and it's when do you find time to do that? And it's when you have your book looks and you think, and they're saying, oh, well, why have they got so little science, for example? Well, actually, they're out, especially in the summer term.
And we can think of something like that, can't we? Yeah. That happens all the time. Homework. Made for
teachers, by teachers. So, a tricky one and no simple answers, but thank you both very much for your thoughts on our timetabling. So, obviously, quite a contentious one, this one, and we'd love to hear your thoughts. Anything that you would drop, anything that you think needs a place, we touched on perhaps life skills, perhaps you think that's something, or financials or stuff like that, banking perhaps. So do let us know, and we look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Cheers, guys.
Take care. Thank you. For much more content exclusively for teachers by teachers, visit homeworkmagazine.co.uk. Also, please follow us on social media at homework_magazine and at homework_podcast. Homework Podcast is brought to you by Iguanas Producciones.